Okay, this evening I want us to begin to focus our attention on books that we very often categorize as the historical books of the Old Testament. And especially we're thinking of the books of Joshua and Judges and Samuel and Kings. And this is a common way that we categorize them, books of history. Maybe from the time we're a little kid in Bible class, we'll talk about the five books of the law and then the books of history and then the other categories of Old Testament books. And that kind of categorization is fine because certainly these four books that we're looking at tonight, these four books do record history, Old Testament history. But I want us to think about them in a little bit different way. Because if all you do is just think about these books as books recording history, then you're missing an awful lot. And it's very important that we not miss that. So what I want to do this evening is I want to take you to the last book of the Pentateuch, the book of Deuteronomy, and to this section of Deuteronomy in chapter 18. And you recall that we Sunday looked at this book and we overviewed it. And you recall that it is a record, basically, of these three major speeches that Moses gives to the Israelites when they are ready to enter into the Promised Land, cross the Jordan River and enter into the Promised Land. And Moses is not going to be going with them. Moses is near the end of his life. But this is what Moses says here in his speech in Deuteronomy 18, verse 15, beginning. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen. You shall listen to him. This is according to all that you asked of the Lord your God in Horeb on the day of the assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God. Let me not see this great fire anymore, or I will die. And then verse 19 says, it shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. Now I've given you just an excerpt really of that entire paragraph, but when you look at that entire paragraph in Deuteronomy chapter 18, I think it's very obvious that it is a prediction of not just one, but a group of prophets who are going to arise throughout Israel's history after Moses has died and after they enter into the Promised Land. And let me just say parenthetically, people will oftentimes say, well, wait a minute, doesn't the New Testament quote this passage and apply it to Jesus as a prediction of the ultimate prophet to come, Jesus? That's right. But we're not near there yet. Okay, so let's, first of all, just right now, let's just think of this passage in its historical context and what was just this first level point that it was trying to make. And first of all, what it's talking about is a group of prophets that God would raise up, like Moses, who would reveal God's future messages to the people. And notice what it says is they would be like Moses. Verse 15, God will raise up for you a prophet like me. And then verse 16, he says, this is according to all you asked of the Lord your God in Horeb on the day of the assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord. What is that referring to? What incident, historically, that we've already talked about? Pat. Okay, that incident that's recorded back in the book of Exodus, Exodus chapter 20, when the Israelites had come out of Egypt, they had come to Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai, and God had, so to speak, come down from heaven to the top of Mount Sinai, and the mountain quaked, and there was thunder, and the sound of the trumpet, and the lightning, and then the voice of God spoke the Ten Commandments to the people directly. And what was the reaction on the part of the people? It frightened them nearly to death. And that's exactly the impact God wanted it to have. He wanted them to fear him, to revere him, and recognize who it was that they were dealing with. Yes, he was a God of compassion, but he was their God, and he was a fearsome, awesome God. But they said, Moses, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God. Let me not see this great fire anymore or I will die. And they asked Moses to get God's message and to then relay that message to them. And that's what God was referring to here and saying that was a very good thing that they said. That's exactly the reaction I wanted them to have. And so what this was setting up was the need for a prophet, a messenger, who would get God's message and then relay that message to the people. And so that's what this passage is talking about. And as you go throughout the rest of the Old Testament history, what you observe is that throughout Israel's history, there was a group of men known as the group of the prophets. And just like you had priests and they were known to the people, just like you had sages or wise men who would give wise counsel, well, there also were the band of the prophets. In fact, what's the name for that group you see all the way through the book of Kings? Anyone know? They're called the sons of the prophets. Sons of the prophets. That didn't mean that they were biologically the children of the prophets, though some of them might have been. But the whole point of that was these are a group of men who are the disciples of usually a main prophet in each generation. Each generation would have a major prophet who would be leading the people. And you'd have a group of prophets who were assisting him and recording messages and also recording the history of the people. And so this is the point that I want you to see. Is that when we think about, well, I'll tell you what, but before I get to that next point. When we think about these books of Old Testament history, you need to think of them as being written by this band of prophets. Now, we don't always know who the particular authors were, but it was men from this group of prophets. And so these books that we refer to as books of history are really prophetic messages. And I want to come back to that point in just a moment. I haven't mentioned this the other day. You know, we talk about the Pentateuch being the law of Moses. And those are the five books of Moses. And Moses wrote them. And that's correct. That's absolutely right to speak of them that way. And the rest of the Bible does speak of those books as the five books of Moses. But when you look at the final format of those five books, I think it becomes pretty obvious, if you look carefully, that the final format in which they are in was not the format that Moses himself put them in, but after Moses had died, Moses' material was then put in the format that we have now with these books. There was some editing of this. From this band of prophets, to put it in the format that we have now. The most obvious example of that is in the book of Deuteronomy. What part of Deuteronomy can you probably be pretty sure Moses himself didn't write? Yeah, the very last chapter that records his death. You know. And now, I'll say this. I had someone one time tell me, well, but God could have revealed all that to Moses ahead of time, and he would have written it beforehand. God's powerful enough to do that. And I agree, God is. But I don't think that's probably the likely thing that God did there. And that's the kind of thing that you see, is there are several things throughout the Pentateuch that are actually indications that the final format of those five books was actually put in that format by this group of the prophets. So they were preserving all this material from Moses. And that's what you see with these four books of history. The ancient Jews, just a little bit after the time of Jesus, they called these four books the former prophets. They didn't classify them as books of history. That's our classification. Their classification for them was the former prophets. And the reason why they called them that, I think, should be obvious to you now. Because they recognized that these four books were written by this band of the prophets, the sons of the prophets. And it was material that had, yes, been written and handed down, but the final format of all of this material was compiled by this group of prophets. And so these are these inspired men. They are giving this revelation from God, but these revelations from God are historical narratives. And that right there is something that is kind of strange to a lot of people. A lot of people just don't realize that that's what prophets would be doing. When we think of the term prophet, or when most people think of the term prophet, what do they probably think of as the job of a prophet? To foretell the future. I mean, just our English word, to prophesy. Isn't that what that would suggest? If someone's going to prophesy, people take that to mean, oh, he's going to predict the future. And it certainly is true that this band of prophets, their oracles sometimes did that. But most of the time, that's not what the prophets were doing, giving oracles that would foretell the future. In fact, a lot of times what they were doing in their oracles that they would give would be giving messages that pertain to the immediate current events. And also, as you see here, they were recording the past. And they were putting the past in this kind of book form here. And so I want you just to think about the significance of this. The fact that it's these prophets of God whom God wants to record the history of the nation. What would that suggest to you is maybe God's purpose in all of that? Why does God want these prophets to record the history of the nation? And why the prophets? What's the point of all that? Anybody have a thought on that? Okay, I guess not. Well, then let me see if I can't help us out here. Remember we talked about Sunday, the book of Deuteronomy? And remember how we looked at the various sections, the fact that even paralleled the kind of vassal treaties that they had in that second millennium B.C., the days of Moses. And God used that format. And in Deuteronomy 27 through 29, you have the blessings and curses section. And you might want to just turn back over to that section real quick. Because what God was doing here in this speech of Moses was having Moses relate to the people that if they obeyed this Mosaic covenant, then they would be blessed. But if they did not obey that Mosaic covenant, then they would be cursed. And you remember in chapter 28, like verse 2, all these blessings will come upon you and overtake you if you obey the Lord your God. Blessed you shall be in the city, blessed shall you be in the country, blessed shall be the offspring of your body and the produce of the ground, and so on. And then verse 15, skip down there. But it shall come about if you do not obey the Lord your God to observe all his commandments and his statutes with which I charge you today, that all these curses will come upon you. Cursed shall you be in the city, and cursed shall you be in the country. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Cursed shall be the offspring of your body and the produce of the ground, and so on. And so what the book of Deuteronomy was saying, what Moses himself had said in his earlier speeches to the people, was that their future history was either going to be a history of blessing if they kept God's covenant, or cursing if they rebelled against God's covenant. It was up to them. So having said all that, I'm going to come back to my question. Why do you think God then had these prophets who would take the role of Moses in the future and relay God's messages, why did God have these prophets as the ones who would record their history? What do you think is the point of that, Dave?
For our benefit, for us to know what happened when people of God disobeyed him.
Okay, I think that's exactly right. And if you're looking at the Israelites, the original recipients of these books, that certainly was the point there. But how about even a little more specific than that, John?
I was thinking that
Okay. Okay. Yeah, everyone just think about what you all already know about what those four books record regarding the history of the Israelite people. What description would you give of their history, just in a nutshell? Huh? Okay. Valleys and mountains. Okay. All right. Sometimes they were faithful, sometimes they weren't. Was it probably about 50-50? Most of the time they were, or half the time they were faithful, half the time they were unfaithful. Is that probably about how you would view it? I hope not. That's not how Stephen overviewed it. Remember in Acts 7, when Stephen just overviewed their entire history? You know, Stephen read these books too, you know. And I mean, Stephen overused that history, and basically his synopsis of it all was, which one of the prophets did your forefathers not persecute? You know. I mean, yeah, there were some mountains, but there were a lot more valleys than mountains. There were a lot more times when they were unfaithful. And so if you want to look at the history of Israel in terms of the blessings and the curses, and those two possible futures that Moses laid out for them, how would you describe their history? Blessing or curse? Really was curses. I mean, that's the predominant theme throughout their history. Now, this is what I want you to see when you look at these books. These books are written by prophets of God who are in the role of mediator like Moses was. I don't mean that they were lawgivers like Moses. Moses was the prophet par excellence. But they were still in that role of communicating God's message to the people. And these prophets are recording this history. And I want you to understand they have a religious purpose for what they are recording. They have a religious purpose. In other words, they are not just trying to record every event that occurred. Maybe we don't stop and think about that. But you know, any historian is going to select those events that he thinks are the most significant and salient events. Well, these prophets of God, they have a religious purpose. And they're trying to teach a religious message to the people. They're trying to make a religious point. And so they're not just recording anything and everything that occurred throughout Israel's history. They are recording those events of Israel's calamitous history and explaining that the reason why Israel's history was so calamitous was because the people rejected the law of Moses throughout the majority of their history. Does everyone see why that was such an important message to be given to the people? I mean, just stop and think about this. Maybe at times we're so familiar with these things that the impact doesn't really hit us. But if Yahweh really is the one true God, and Israel is His special nation with whom He has this special covenant relationship, then what would you expect, just on the surface, would be the future history of such a people? You think it ought to be pretty good, right? I mean, if He really is the one true God, shouldn't His people be head and shoulders above everybody else? Shouldn't they be the most powerful nation, the richest nation, the most blessed nation? Shouldn't they be the happiest people? And yet, what was true of the history of those people? Just the opposite. Why? You see, that is a question that has to be answered. Because if the prophets don't answer that, and explain that here's the reason why it was so awful a history, because the people rejected God's law and God had foretold that would be the result. If they don't explain that, what are a lot of people going to think is the reason why their history was so awful and calamitous and not wonderful? Maybe Yahweh really isn't whom he claims to be. Maybe Yahweh really isn't the powerful God. Maybe Baal is the God that we should be serving. After all, Baal was here before Yahweh was here, wasn't he? The Canaanites were worshiping Baal before we got here. You see how their minds would probably work? You know, if serving Yahweh hasn't got us anything, if we haven't improved our lot, why would we serve Yahweh? Do people in our day ever think like that when they look at their circumstances in life and say, well, you know, what's this religion stuff doing for me? That's exactly what people think. That's exactly how their minds reason. So they just say, let's just chuck the whole thing in. This is why this was so important. This is why these books had to be written. And so these books are serving the purpose of explaining the reason why our nation's history has been so terrible. It's our fault. It's because we rejected the covenant that he gave us originally. And back when he gave us the covenant through Moses, the very first prophet, he told us this would be the result if we didn't keep the covenant. So far from Yahweh not being the true God, really our history is fulfilling the prediction and proving he is the true God. He was faithful to what he said in the covenant. He promised that if we disobeyed him, he would curse us. And look what's happened. He's kept his word. We're the ones that have it. That's what these prophets are doing. So when you study Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, you've really got to see them in that light. And if all you do is just think of these books kind of like the way that you think of, you know, like when you're studying American history, you know, in your college class or something, you're just kind of looking at events. But, you know, it's just events on a timeline, you know. How did we get from here to there, you know? I mean, if that's all you're doing with Old Testament history, then you're just missing it. Okay, there's a religious point that is here. There's a religious argument that's being made by these prophets as they write these books. Now, let me just say one more thing on that, just to kind of amplify this. Anybody here ever heard of Omri? King Omri. Does that ring a bell with anybody? I'll give you a hint. He was an Old Testament king. Oh, that really helps us a lot, Marto. We appreciate that one. Give you another hint. He was a king of the northern kingdom of Israel. Does that mean anything to you? Don't feel bad. If you really don't remember who Omri is, or you're kind of, well, that name maybe kind of rings a bell, you know, or something. Had a dog once named that, or, you know, or something like that. But, you know, don't feel too bad. Omri was one of the most significant political figures in Israel's history. Politically and on the international scene, he was one of the most significant kings in all of the northern kingdom of Israel's history. But you probably don't really remember who he is. And you know why? Because in the book of Kings, there's about that much space devoted to him. But there's a whole bunch of space devoted to his son, and I think you probably have heard of his son, a guy named King Ahab. Anybody heard of him? Probably King Ahab is the most well-known king of the north. To everybody here. We've all heard of Ahab. We all know about it. In fact, what immediately comes to your mind about King Ahab? His lovely wife, Jezebel, just a sterling character, wasn't she? Ahab and Jezebel, this charming couple stand out in our minds because of the book of Kings as two of the wickedest people in Israel's history. But from a political point of view, in the ancient Near Eastern world, Ahab was nothing. His father, Omri, was a big deal. From the standpoint of what we might call a secular historian's point of view, the ancient world in Mesopotamia, they viewed Omri as so significant that they referred to the land of Palestine as Omri land. I know that sounds like an amusement park or something, but that's what they called it, the land of Omri. Even after Omri was long since dead. But the authors of Kings, they give scarce attention to Omri, but a whole bunch of attention to his son Ahab. Why? Because as far as their purpose is concerned, explaining the history of the nation and why religiously their nation had become apostate and that caused them to go downhill because they violated God's covenant, that message, Ahab was much more significant than Omri. I mean, Omri wasn't a good king, but he wasn't near as religiously an apostate as Ahab was. And Ahab caused more problems for his nation as far as the violation of God's covenant was concerned than Omri ever did. And so that's why the prophets, when they write the book of Kings, they give very minimal attention to Omri, but a whole bunch of attention to Ahab. That's their purpose, a religious purpose explaining the reason why our nation has had the history it's had is because we rejected God's covenant, but God was true to his word, and he brought these curses upon us. Does that make sense to everybody? That is just crucial for us to see these books in that light. Dave? And again, you know, I think back of Stephen's comment. That's why Stephen said, which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? You know, so their work was largely in vain as far as the people of their own generation was concerned. Okay? All right. That's just kind of overviewing all these books. I'll skip over that. Let's talk a little bit then about Joshua and Judges specifically. On Sunday morning, we'll talk about the books of Samuel and Kings. But right now, let's just focus our attention upon Joshua and Judges. And I hope everyone has a copy of the sheet, the handout there. If you just look at the outline of Joshua, it's just real simple. Real simple structure to the book. The first half of the book is recording how God used Joshua, after Moses died, he used Joshua to lead the people across the Jordan River into Canaan, and over maybe a 20-year period of time at the most, conquered those major Canaanite peoples who had the domination over the land of Canaan at that time. And so the first 12 chapters are talking about all of those battles. And then the second half of the book are talking about how after they had conquered those major Canaanite powers, they then were in a position to allot the territories to the respective tribes of Israel. And so each tribe would then be able to then go into its respective territory and remove the remaining Canaanites from that territory and then dwell there. So that's what the book of Joshua is all about. The first half of the book talking about how they cross the Jordan River and they conquer the central area here. Jericho was the major central city, Ai. And then they moved down and had a major battle with a coalition of Canaanite kings, Jerusalem, and these surrounding cities. So they conquered the dominant powers in the south. Then they went up north in the region of Galilee, and they conquered major Canaanite armies that were associated with the various city-states, all up here in this northern region of Galilee, around Hazor and the upper northernmost part of the land and all that surrounding area. So that by the time Joshua dies, the people have conquered all the major powers. You still got a lot of Canaanites there. But Israel is now the dominant power per God's promise. And now they've just got to go into their respective territories and remove, it's sort of a mop-up operation. Remove the remaining foreigners from the land. Make sense? That's what the book of Joshua is all about. Look over then at Joshua chapter 24. Remember what Moses did right before the Israelites crossed the Jordan River, and right before Moses died, he assembled all the people, gave them those major speeches. Guess what Joshua does? Exactly the same thing. Joshua 24, here's Joshua's farewell speech. And it's a speech of exhortation, much like Moses. Look at verse 14. Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve Him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. Now let me just pause there. He's saying, put away the gods that your father served beyond the river. What's the river? What's the river? Yeah, you're thinking too small if you say the Jordan. In the ancient Near Eastern world, that Fertile Crescent, the river which divided the entire area into half, or in half, was the Euphrates River. Okay, and remember that Abraham and his clan, you know, his father Terah and their family, they live beyond the Euphrates River, on the other side of the river. And so he says, put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river. Did you realize that? That Terah and family, their clan, they had been pagans before Yahweh revealed himself to Terah and Abraham. So put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt. So when they were in Egypt during those centuries, you know, they hadn't always been serving Yahweh there. They were serving Egyptian gods too. And serve the Lord. Verse 15. If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve. Whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. That term Amorite there is just another name for Canaanites. So those people that they have been driving out, all those gods of the Amorites or the Canaanites, that's chiefly the god Baal and his pantheon. Asherah, the female deity, Ashtart, fertility goddess. So Baal and his pantheon, that was the common gods of that area of Canaan. So he's saying, all right, you put those gods away, or make a decision as to what gods you're going to serve. If it's disagreeable to serve the Lord, well then what gods are better than the Lord? Are you going to serve the gods your fathers used to serve beyond the river? Are you going to serve the gods of these Amorites whom you've dispossessed from the land? Does everyone see the implied argument there? If the gods of the Amorites, if the Amorites have been defeated by the Israelites, well then what's that say about Israel's God and their gods? Yahweh's obviously more powerful. Their gods were impotent when they had to come up against Yahweh. But, you know, he's kind of being facetious. If that's the gods you want to serve, okay, bunch of losers. But as for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh. And that's what Joshua said. So here's this admonition to the people. And every Israelite household is going to have to make their own decision about that. And he's hoping and praying they'll make the right one. Unfortunately, when we get to the book of Judges, we see that they don't make the right choice. Okay, question or comment about Joshua? That's really what the book of Joshua is all about. Okay. Let me make one other comment about this allotment of territory. What's the significance of God, after Joshua's battles, allotting all these territories to the respective tribes? What's the... Is there a religious point in all that? Isaac?
God delivers his promises.
Okay, God delivers his promises. How would that have reference to God's promises? I mean, I think you're right on target, but I want you to follow up with it. Okay, what did God promise Abraham? He would give Abraham's seed this land. Okay, well, he is very boldly allotting the territory. He's parceling it out as if he owns it. Well, that's exactly who Yahweh is. He does own it. He is parceling it out. And, well, my goodness. There's a little demon in this thing, apparently. Oh, well. Okay. All right. So, you know, God is acting as the owner of this land, which he is. And he is parceling that out to the tribes as he was decreeing. Do you recall how that was handled? How did each tribe know what territory God wanted them to have? They cast lots for it. Now we might say, oh, well, it was just chance. But no, that's why the author of the proverb said the lot is in the hand of Yahweh. I mean, so they cast lots, but God was behind all of that. And so, you know, those maps, I even showed you one a moment ago, with all the territories allotted to those respective tribes, well, that was the land area that each tribe was given by God. And then within each of those tribes, each family in that tribe was allotted their portion of that tribal territory. And that was their inheritance. So that's the whole point. But see, all of this is before they really have taken full occupation of all those territories. So this is a very bold promise God is making here. When he allots it, you know, it's he is confidently saying, oh, this is yours, you know. But there's still a lot of foreigners who are still in those territories that are going to be vying for all that. They're not going to want to give up all that territory. And so the Israelite tribes are going to have to go into battle again with them and drive them out. But God is very boldly and confidently saying, but here's your allotment of territory. Here's your allotment of the land of milk and honey. That's what all this is. Okay. So now, of course, what we're going to see in the book of Judges is the next generation, though, just sort of loses the significance and the insight about all of this. But we'll look at that in just a moment. Yeah. Yeah, it was not that land rush, you know, that we did, you know, where all the wagons, you know, and they fire the gun and everybody just, you know, first one there puts his stake in, you know. It was nothing like that. It was all handled very orderly, and each tribe had their respective territory. Yeah. Okay. Book of Judges. Look at Judges, the first two chapters, and the way that the book is written, it's giving you an overview of this entire Judges era. So those generations after Joshua and his generation dies out, the following generations, that's the era of the judges. And the way that the prophetic authors of Judges write this book, the way God inspired them to write it, is to give an overview in the first couple of chapters. And what you see is that the people are not being real faithful to God. The opening verses of chapter 1 talk about how each of the tribes begin to go into their respective territories to drive out the Canaanites that were still in their territories. And they start doing that, but then you begin to see that they kind of don't finish the job. And it gets a little bit tougher. And they decide to leave some of the Canaanites in their allotted territories. Now, God had told them, you get rid of every one of those Canaanites. Drive them all out. Why did God want them to be driven completely out? Okay, one reason was to judge the Canaanites. That's part of what God was doing here. But the other and most important reason is God did not want the Canaanites living among Israel because he knew they would influence Israel into paganism rather than to continue to keep the Mosaic covenant. And sure enough, that's exactly what happens. And so what you see then, as you look at the latter part of chapter 2, is that the... Good night. See, I don't even know what's going on, but y'all do. What in the... Oh, man. Well, forget it. Remind me to write a letter of complaint to Bill Gates. Anyway, look at your outline there. And what you see in the first couple of chapters is an overview of this entire Judges era. And basically what happens, I got to say all this quickly now, is that when the people begin to disobey Yahweh and don't drive out the Canaanites that are still in their allotted territories. And when they start to forsake his covenant, Yahweh basically says, all right, I'm going to just leave them there. I'm not going to drive them out for you. And he says they will be a snare and a problem for you, which is, again, part of what he promised in the blessings and curses section of the law. And that's exactly what happens. Okay, look at chapter 2. And verse 13 started. And here's the overview of the book of, or of the Judges era. So they forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtaroth. That's the female counterpart of Baal, his female consort. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies around them so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had spoken and as the Lord had sworn to them, so they were severely distressed. This is the prophet talking. He's saying this happened to us historically because we violated God's law, and he told us it would happen. He was true to his word. Verse 16. Then the Lord raised up judges who delivered them from the hands of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they played the harlot after other gods and bowed themselves down to them. They turned aside quickly from the way in which their fathers had walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. They did not do as their fathers. And what he goes on to say is that with each judge that he would raise up to deliver them from their persecutors, they would then, after a while, reject God's law all over again, and they would get even worse than the preceding generation had been. And then they'd repent, and then God would feel sorry for them, send them a judge to deliver them, and it would just be this repeating cycle all over again. And they would get worse and worse and worse, And that's what the entire Judges era is all about. And by the time you get to the end of the Judges era, you've got a nation of people who has so gone astray from God's covenant that their leader, Samson, though he is a man of faith, I mean, you all know from reading the story of Samson, he lived a terribly immoral life. But, you know, that's the kind of people God had to work with by that time. They've gotten so bad. Where among the best of them is a guy like Samson who was still very immoral, living with Delilah, living with the Philistine women, you know. So by the time the Judges era comes to an end, the nation has reached its lowest point ever. And they've had a calamitous history. And they still are fighting to retain control of the land. That's not the way it should have been. They should already, long before this, had been firmly planted in the land. But instead, the entire Judges era was constant fighting and battle to just hold on to the land. Because they forsook God's covenant. And that's what the book of Judges is trying to teach. That message right there. It was about 350 years of turmoil because the people refused to follow God's law. It shouldn't have been that way. It didn't have to be that way. But that's the way it was. Okay. Sunday morning, we'll look at Samuel and Kings.